And we're on.
Good evening, everybody. And thank you all very much
for coming to the second in a series of joint events between the Center of Modern Torah Leadership and the English with Sharon. This particular series is focusing on the nature of modern Orthodoxy in Israel. It is my pleasure to welcome this evening Rabbi Dr. Adam Furziger, an old friend from many years ago, who has been involved on a whole series of levels in both creating the phenomenon and studying it. As he'll talk about, that he moved to Israel originally not as an academic, but as a rabbi, and over the years has now developed something in the Luxembourg Center, right?
Rappaport Center.
Oh, one of those Jewish names.
Right.
The Rappaport Center at Bar-Ilan University, where he's become one of the, I would think, perhaps the most influential sociologist of modern Orthodoxy in both America and Israel. And I look forward very much to tonight's conversation.
So first of all, it is a pleasure to be here. I don't know if people recall, but I was here a couple of years ago as a scholar in residence. So if you don't remember me, that's good because I can repeat myself. If you do remember me, that's probably better because it means that maybe I made some sort of impression. But I will tell you something to be very familiar, which is that just a week and a half ago, I attended the wedding of Ellie Stone's daughter.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if there's anyone here. I don't know if Maury's here, but
we're all members of the family.
Just right. So see, that makes a nice connection, yeah, right? So we're all family here. We're all friendly, and that was very lovely and very special. Okay, so I'm gonna. I was asked to make a little bit of an introduction, introduce myself a little bit, and just raise some ideas very briefly, and then I think that my understanding is that the main event is to have an interchange with Rabbi and with the Rabbi Klaver,
and
with all the people here. Okay, and that sounds like a lot of fun for me. So my wife and I. I'll just start from the beginning. My background is a New York Jew. I grew up in the Bronx in Riverdale. Went to SAR Ramaz. Studied in Israel for 2 years at BMT and in Gush. Came back to YU for a couple of years. Then we got married. We moved to Yerushalayim. I was in the Gris Kol of Yeshiva University. At the same time, my wife is an occupational therapist. Actually, she just finished her PhD in neuroscience. But she was finishing her OT at the time. I was studying in Gris. With Rav Lichtenstein and doing my smicha, and late at night I was writing my master's thesis for Jacob Katz, the renowned historian, and that was a great privilege. I studied with him. Were you in that class with me in Revel? Maybe
take Jacob Katz.
Okay, and that was a great thing. And then I was writing my master's there. And after I completed my master's and finished smicha, we Naomi and I decided to stay in Israel. It was a big decision. We decided that we're going to just not make a break, but we're going to establish our lives there, and it made things a lot easier. I will tell you, for those who contemplate or have relatives, I have four siblings, three of which now live in Israel, and my mom lives in Israel too. So it worked out, but for a long time we were there on our own. It was tough. Subsequently, we moved to Kfar Saba, which is near Ra'anana. People are more familiar with Ra'anana in the Sharon area. Now, this is not just autobiographical, but it's relevant to our discussion. The reason we moved to Kfar Saba is because I was offered the only position in the state of Israel of assistant rabbi. No, let alone, you know, people talk, is there a rabbinate in Israel? Here we go, assistant rabbi. Actually, the rabbi of a shul in Kfar Saba was someone, he's not the rabbi there anymore, but Rabbi Joseph Leibowitz, maybe some of you know him. He was the rabbi previously of the Orthodox Synagogue in Berkeley, California. He made Aliyah, he was teaching in Pardes, and he was the rabbi of a shul, but he traveled a lot for Pardes, and for a number of reasons, because he wanted someone to work with him, so he brought us in. I thought we'd be there for a year or two, and we've now been living in Kfar Saba for 20 years. So it's been a nice short visit. I stayed with that shul for a couple of years, two years, and I was also involved in activities bridging gaps between kids, Israeli kids from the center of the country and from peripheral communities through the Young Israel movement in Israel. And at a certain point, I decided to finish my master's, and I wanted to continue my PhD, and I chose to do that at Bar-Ilan. And it was just at the time that the big aliyah from the former Soviet Union was beginning. And in life, and I think in education and in all sorts of public activities, you really can't plan. But sometimes things just fall into place, thank God. And it was unbelievably exciting time. I was asked to start the Mechina for Olim Chadashim, the pre-academic or transitional year program in Bar-Ilan, to enable these hundreds and hundreds of students who had high school degrees make the transition into the Israeli university system. And that included from not just from an educational perspective or from an academic perspective, but from a Jewish cultural perspective as well. And I did that for 7 years. And at the time, I was doing my PhD. Eventually, I finished my PhD, and I was eventually offered the opportunity to become a full-time academic in Bar-Ilan. And today, I am vice chairman of the graduate program in contemporary Jewry at Bar-Ilan. My research focuses on two areas: Europe in the 19th century and early 20th century, and America and Israel in particular in the late 20th and or second half of the 20th and even early 21st century. I'm a historian by training, but Jacob Katz, for those of you who may be familiar, one of his chidushim, one of his novel contributions to the study of Jewish history, it seems sort of obvious now, but at the time it wasn't, was to introduce sociological tools and methods to analyzing historical phenomena, which began really with his classic work, Tradition and Crisis, Masor du Mashper, and that was really a revolution. Today it's sort of taken for granted that we must use those tools, but I've certainly tried to advance that and use that in my work, which My early work, I wrote a book called Exclusion and Hierarchy, which is about the development of Orthodox attitudes towards non-observant Jews in the modern period. As Rabbi Klapper said, I've focused a lot of my attention in the last couple of years on assimilation in North America, and particularly responses to assimilation along the range from modern Orthodoxy, which is hardly responding at all, to the conservative and reform movements, who are responding in very creative but often from an Orthodox perspective problematic ways, but extremely, extremely creative. I just published an article where I spoke about a new phenomenon within the conservative movement called Karov Yisrael, which is a non-Jewish wife of a Jew who doesn't want to convert, but she's active in a Jewish community. There's a new category which is being developed now, Karov Yisrael, a relative of an Israelite, which is a hybrid, sort of not a non-Jew, but not a Jew. So that is a response to assimilation. It might be one that it seems a little bit far-fetched for some of us who live within the halachic universe, but it is certainly something which exists. And also, actually, I've done a lot of work about Haredi society and the ways in which Haredim or the yeshivish or right-wing community in many ways is being more maverick and being more dynamic in their approach to the unaffiliated or non-observant world than the modern Orthodoxy has been. And I've written about that. Actually, tomorrow I'll be giving a talk at the AJS conference in Boston about the Soviet Jewry movement and how the involvement of Orthodoxy during the 1960s and 70s in the Soviet Jewry movement. There are definitely people in this room who were inspired and who were involved in that, and maybe that will resonate for you. But today, Rabbi Klapper asked me to address issues related to Israel, to the development, tensions, focus of religious life in Israel. And I'll begin by talking a little bit about the interplay or lack thereof between Israeli Judaism, Israeli religious Zionism, and American modern Orthodox. So I'm just going to talk for a few more minutes, and then we'll get to them. So far, so good. We're okay. And I have to say that when Rabbi Klaffer approached me, I was really thrilled. I was thrilled for two reasons. First of all, because I've known Rabbi Klaffer for many, many years in YU, and always had a tremendous respect for him and appreciated his sincerity, his depth, and his unique way of looking at things, and that was always special. But also, my brother and sister-in-law lived in Cambridge, and they were doing fellowships at the time. They're both psychiatrists, and they became connected or involved with the Harvard Hillel community at the time that Rabbi Klaffer was the rabbi there. And I don't know if I had the opportunity to ever thank him or show my appreciation, but I can tell you that at that moment, there could not have been a better rabbi for my brother than you. And I remember when he once called me up, he said, "Adam, there's this guy Klaffer. He's really interesting. He's really..." I said, "Yeah, he is really interesting. You know, hook up with him. You're not gonna regret it." And he didn't regret it. And so this is a way of hakarat hatov for what you did for my brother, for our family. Yeah, it's very, very appreciated. When I was in the Gris Kollel in the Gris Institute in of Yeshiva University in Jerusalem, at a certain point, Rabbi Lam, the former president, now the chancellor of Yeshiva University, considered one of the most important leaders of American modern Orthodoxy, came to speak to us. And after he gave his talk, he asked if we had any questions. And I was very, very interested in Israeli society, and it seems so absurd to me that Israeli shuls don't have rabbis. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand. It seems that it was so obvious growing up in America, and I grew up in a shul which had some very dynamic, a very broad variety of rabbis. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg was the rabbi when I was younger. Jonathan Rosenblatt is the rabbi of the shul, and other interesting, Joshua Schmidman. There were thinking, dynamic leaders, people who really were centers of communal life and brought energy and passion to our Judaism. So I asked Rabbi Lam, "When do you think Israeli society is going to recognize the need to have the pulpit rabbinates?" So he said to me, or he said to us, the Gris group, he said, "When conservative and reform Judaisms make inroads into Israeli society, then they'll realize they need modern Orthodox rabbis too." So I thought that was interesting. So that I started to think to myself, well, so should I be rooting for reform and conservative Judaism? Because if they make it, then we'll make it, right? Right? So I can tell you that from my perspective, reform and conservative Judaisms have grown and have expanded in Israel in the last 20 years. But it would be difficult to say, I'm trying to speak and smile at the same time, it would be difficult to say that they've really, they've carved out a niche primarily with Anglos and with mixed couples and in certain particular places. And there are 50 conservative shuls in Israel today, and probably a similar amount of, maybe a little less, but there are plenty of reform synagogues too. But really peripheral. And it would be hard to argue that those movements have really become part of the fabric of mainstream Israeli society. And then, so then, the, you know, based on Rabbi Lamb's thesis, the suggestion would be that then the American-style pulpit rabbinates are also not very significant. And despite the fact that I have tremendous, I know Rabbi Stav was here, and I have tremendous respect for the work of Tzohar and the work of Rabbi Ron and Neuwirth, who's really trying to develop their rabbinic division, or community rabbinate division, I would say that the Orthodox rabbinate as a model that we have here has also not established itself in Israel. There are shuls of rabbis. There are maybe a few that have the sense of identification between the rabbi and the community that we are used to here. For the most part, rabbis are looked at as people who can give a shir, give a psak, who have another job. There's very little funding for rabbis. The assumption by Israelis still today is that the state provides you with your religious needs. So there is some development, but I would say minimal. I would also say that extending from Rabbi Lamb's thesis, if we are going to depend upon the expansion of the liberal movements in order for the Orthodox rabbinate to develop as a communal model, then it's never going to happen, because I don't think that there is really a flourishing future for these ideas. And I'm bringing that as something that I think is worthy of us of us becoming aware. But I'm also bringing that to point out certain basic structural differences. And I think that's really where you have to start before we get into ideational things. Basic structural differences between Israel and the United States that we may be aware of, but I think that they're the point of departure. When I teach my students, Israeli students, about American Jewry, so sometimes I'll sit with them and go through synagogue ordinance or synagogue charters. And we'll read, you know, learning about conservative Judaism. I'll read, you know, I don't know if you're aware, in most conservative schools today, they have an interfaith committee or an a committee that just sets down the bylaws for each shul for how do we deal with intermarriage, because it's rampant and it's a reality. That's the way it's done today. So I'll sit there and read that, and they'll look at me and they'll say, so, aval machbat is a bit knesset katan. And it's like, it's just a little shul, you know, who cares? And so I explained to them that in America, the shul is like the medina. That's what I say to them. I say, see, it may be like just this little part of people's lives, but for a person who is affiliated, no matter what denomination you're in, and no matter how many times a year you come to shul, your sort of Judaism and your collective Jewish life is governed by that institution. And synagogue membership is sort of like citizenship. So let's say this example of Karov Yisrael that I brought is sort of like it's a type of ezrachut, like a citizenship, like that's trying to be created, because it's sort of like the equivalent of in Israel, where they'll, you know, you have the law of return, where these people aren't Jewish according to halacha, but there's a parallel between the synagogue and what goes on in the state. The difference is that it's all the difference in the world, because here it's this little sub-community that has very little to do with everything we do outside of this shul. And in Israel, we have this entire country which has secular frameworks which have nothing to do with religion, but there's so much of the country that goes on in the Knesset, that goes on in municipal government, that goes on in all different facets that relate to religion, coercion, laws, status, etc. So it helps the Israeli students to tell them that the synagogue is like a little mini state. I'm wondering if it helps us in this conversation to recognize how different Israeli Jewish life is from American Jewish life. And here I want to sort of summarize and then go to the questions. But what I'm leading to is when we think about the relationship between Israeli religious Zionism and American modern Orthodoxy, well, certainly one aspect of it is, you know, how we as enlightened modern Orthodox American Jews can influence Israeli society. So I think the starting point is really the point of departure. I asked Rabbi Klapper, why are you doing this? I think the starting point is that we have to learn to understand Israeli society. I think we have to learn to appreciate how different it is from American Jewish life. And then we have to think very creatively what aspects of that which we have created here and which is valuable here can interface positively with Israeli life, and what aspects, even if they must be wonderful, beautiful, amazing, are just irrelevant to the Israeli scene. So it may seem obvious to us. I'll just give one example, and it's a little bit of a controversial example, but I want to be a little bit provocative, and then I'll be happy to to interface with all of us. I was sitting at lunch today with a very nice group of people in Brookline, and someone said to me, "You know, it's so offensive. My sister made Aliyah about 15 years ago, and they live in a town in Israel, and her daughter's getting married. And the daughter went with the young man she's engaged to the rabbinate to register, and they started asking all sorts of questions about her Jewishness and whether she's Jewish and if she could prove she's Jewish, and they brought my ketubah, and you know which rabbis are signed on my ketubah on my sister's ketubah? You know which rabbis are signed on that?" And she mentioned rabbis that are, you know, pretty well known in our circles. And could you believe that the rabbinate in this local town wasn't impressive to them? Those rabbis are there and that just didn't move them at all? Lo hizizotam, as they say in Hebrew. So I said, yeah. So I said, I don't understand. They're so offensive. I said, well, think about it this way. In this town, I said two things. I said, first of all, when I'm an academic, but I also, again, I was a rabbi of a shul for 10 years, and I continue to do certain rabbinic functions. I perform a lot of weddings for non-observant couples. So when I sit with a couple, the way it works is they come to me to perform the wedding, but all the bureaucracy is done through the local rabbinate. It's like, you know, it's like going to, in America, you would go to the marriage bureau, right, for your civil marriage. Do they have that here? Right. Yeah. Okay. So I say to them, when you go to sign up at the rabbinate, imagining you're really going to get your passport. Or imagine you're getting your driver's license. I say, driver's license, I'm going to get married. I said, yeah. But the same type of, when you go to get your driver's license, you think, oh, this guy is a bureaucrat. He's been doing this for 20 years. He's bored out of his mind. It's just another person. You're just a number. So I said, fortunate or not, the person who's sitting in the rabbinate is exactly the same way. They're a government paid official who's been doing this for the last 20 years. You're just another person. So I said to this woman today, I said, you know what? This person in that local rabbinate, they get a lot of people who were born in Chutz Laaretz to sign up for the rabbinate. And you know, probably most of them are Russians. And the standard thing is, are you Jewish, right? So it would be really nice if they could distinguish between these Olim Kadashim and those Olim Kadashim and recognize the difference between the realities of post-Soviet Russian immigrants and American Orthodox Jews. But from the perspective of this government, you're from Chul. I don't know who your rabbi is. I need proof, and that's all. So my point is that when you're living in a total Jewish society, even if it's a so-called secular state, just the whole way that things function, the whole way that things move, in terms of very basic religious issues, very different than the intimate communal type of Judaism that we cherish and we find to be warm and nurturing, and that creates a disconnect on the personal level. I'm assuming that within our conversation we'll talk on the personal level, but we'll also talk about policy issues and about broader issues that come up. But I hope that just gives a certain perspective that I think I've developed having grown up here in America, but having spent, you know, my adult life in Israel. Okay.
So this has been a great introduction. I just wonder actually if we could, and I think most everyone here does have a sense of the difference between the Israeli, you know, Rabbanut system and what we have here in the States, but perhaps not in complete detail. So if we could address the issue of how the current system of the Rabbanut developed in Israel, a little bit of a historical account, towards describing, not just the history, but describing the current situation with its historical background. By contrast, for instance, I mean, the model that we have here in the States of, as you said, each little kehillah is like a little, you know, piece of a medina in a certain way, and with a rabbinic leader, very typical in this American model. The American model goes back to early Ashkenaz. It's a model of great, you know, it's a great sort of venerability. It goes way back, and it was the model for most of the European, Jewish experience, and even around the Mediterranean basin, until the modern period to some extent. It's the model that jumped to the States, you know, that of having a kehillah with a rav, but it's not the model that ended up in Eretz Yisrael. So how did that happen? That the system as they have it in Eretz Yisrael, which is so different from the Ashkenazic and even in many cases the Sephardic model that had been the rule for centuries and centuries.
I'm going to respond to that more. Is it possible to get just a pen? No, actually, a pen and a piece of paper, just so that I can jot things down as we're going along to make sure that I can. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Maybe you want some water also.
maybe at some point, but right now the pen and paper. I'm sorry. That gives me time to think the answer. You know? anyone have any ideas? Okay. Thank you very much, Rabbi. Okay, so now I knew the answer before, but the problem is that the answer is, I hope you will assume that Mara Da'atra, as far as you, in this particular case means halakha and policy, okay. Because I don't agree with you.
Okay.
Is that, I hope
that's fine.
That,
no,
okay, because I want to, with respect.
This is a conversation.
Actually, I think that the model in America is hybrid, and the model in Israel is much closer to the model that was in Ashkenaz, and certainly the model that was in early modern Europe, and to a certain degree, even in Mediterranean lands. That is that rabbis were geographically appointed. A kehillah, if we talk about medieval or early modern Europe, wasn't a shul. It was all the Jews living in a given area. That's first of all. So it could be there was only one synagogue, but the rabbi wasn't a synagogue rabbi. The rabbi was the rav of the kehillah. As far as I know, well, there was one terrible experiment with that in New York. Rabbi Jacob Joseph was brought, and they tried to make a Rav Kehillah in New York, and it was a total failure. The only community I'm aware of in the United States which has a successful communal rabbinate along the European lines is Elizabeth, New Jersey, the Teitz family, where really Rabbi Pinchas Teitz and his son are there are rabbis of shuls, but they're all underneath his auspices. But in Europe in medieval times, you had the Rav of the Kehillah. His main job was to be the Av Beit Din, to be the head of the religious court. He usually, rabbis, this is a dirty secret, okay? A lot of people become rabbis because they like to learn. And they figure if they become a rabbi, they can spend more time learning than if they became a lawyer. But they don't really necessarily realize that being a rabbi takes a lot of different skills beyond learning. So that was always the way it was. So what rabbis wanted to do is what they want to learn. So they would make a negotiation. They would say, I want to get paid this amount of money, and I want the community to finance this many students for me so that I can sit and learn every morning. And in the afternoon, I'll do the Beit Din twice a year. Right? Twice a year, I'll give a speech, Shabbos Shuvah and Shabbos HaGadol. And thank you very much. And other than that, you know, maybe I'll supervise the educational cheder a little bit, something like that. So very minimal, but it was mostly a judicial position with some additional aspects that were unclear. Maybe in the 19th century, you know, you have the example, let's say, of Shimshon HaFal Hirsch, who said, let's separate from the Gemeinde, from the Kihila. Let's create a sort of a private synagogue community. But even there, that was only temporary. And eventually what he wanted to do was create a community, but a community that would only be of Orthodox Jews, which was a chidush, which was a novelty. But it was still basically the geographical model. Rav Ir, Rav Kihila, Rav Medina, etc. In the Sephardic tradition, you have something called the Chacham Bashi, which is also like that. So in Israel, basically the system is along those lines, where we have a chief rabbinate, which you had in some places. That's sort of a new thing. The chief rabbinate, really the chief rabbinate of the whole country, although you had them. Shimshon HaFal Hirsch was the chief rabbi of Moravia from 1845 to 1851 before he came to Frankfurt because the Rothschilds invited him. So in Israel, you have, the way it's been set up is you have an institution called the chief rabbinate. And that was instituted already in around 1920. In Palestine, it was when the British came. The British thought that was a good idea for organizing religious life, and the British had a lot to do with that being set up. And you have an Ashkenazi chief rabbi and a Sephardic chief rabbi, and then you have Rabbanei Arim. You have city rabbis, chief rabbi of Petah Tikva, chief rabbi of Jerusalem, chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, chief rabbi of Kfar Saba. Some cities, if they're large enough, might have a Sephardic and an Ashkenazic. Some cities will also have Rabbanei Shechunot, rabbis of neighborhoods. And some synagogues, very rarely, but occasionally will have a Rav Beit Knesset. Occasionally the Rav Ir will be a Rav Beit Knesset, the Rav Shechunot. But now, what do all these rabbis have in common? And this is there anyone French here? They're getting paid by the state. Exactly. In France, rabbis get paid by the state. Yeah, the consistoire, you get paid by the state. There's no this American thing. Well, the American rabbinate is a result of separation of church and state. You can't use government funds to pay for religion. If you ever read the book, and this is relevant to our conversation, Alexis de Tocqueville. He was this French sort of political theorist who came to America in the 1830s, and he wrote this very important book called Democracy in America. He wanted to see, you know, what's this fledgling democracy doing? So he travels around and he writes this passage where he says, I noticed that in France, there's no separation between religion and state. The state gives lots of funding for religion, and the churches are empty. And here in America, there's no funding for the churches, and they're full every Sunday, and that's sort of an argument against coercion and an argument for freedom and for choice, etc. So, actually, I think that the American system, which maybe you see it in England. You see it in Anglo countries a little bit. I just spent some time in England. But even in England, you have the sort of United Synagogue. It's sort of a private, but it's private public. It's, you know, Rabbi Sachs, he's sort of, I don't know how, who pays his salary, actually. I don't know. But the American system is kind of sui generis, this idea that you have a shul, and the members of the shul have to get together, produce funds, and they have to support the Klei Kodesh. They have to support the rabbi, the chazan, et cetera, et cetera. So the Israeli system is a government system, and again, it stems from this idea that we have a Jewish society. One of the things I often teach my students, and when trying to explain to them the complexity and the difficulties of Israeli societies, if you take Jacob Katz's model, so Jacob Katz talks often about the traditional autonomous community. The idea of the Jews in pre-modern times before emancipation, they live in a sort of a state within a state, right? In anything to do with internal Jewish relations, the Kehillah board, which is like a legislative board, they control things. They have a judicial group, that's the rabbi, right? And it's Beit Din. And they have also functions that are more executive, right? They control everything. The only area which is controlled by the non-Jews is that all the Jews pay taxes so that they can have the right of residents, and if Jews ever have interactions, let's say commit a crime against non-Jews, then they'll go to a non-Jewish court. But essentially, Jews have autonomy, there's religious coercion, and Jews live according to the Shulchan Aruch to a great extent. With the rise of emancipation, Jews become citizens of their countries, and then religion becomes privatized to a certain degree, but only... It depends where. You know, in Germany until the year 1876, if you lived in a city in Germany, you had to pay dues to the local Gemeinde, the local Jewish community. Not only that, but the local Jewish community was the one who registered births and deaths. So if you went to an old age home, it had to be the one from your religion. It wasn't, there was still that sense. And so what I tell my students about Israel is that Israel is a post-traditional Jewish society. Why do I call it post-traditional? Because in traditional society, all the Jews were religious, right? Or observant. I like that word better. All the Jews who lived there were observant. Well, they were observant because there was coercion, or because that was what they knew, or as Charles Lieben would say, because it was taken for granted. But that's what Judaism meant. It meant keeping Shabbos, Kashrut, Tarat HaMishpacha, etc. Now, Israeli society, as we all know, is not like that. Israeli society is very diverse in terms of religious observance. And yet, Israeli society is run according to certain Jewish... there are certain Jewish basic laws which are coerced, right? If you're not Jewish, you can't get married. If you're Christian, you can get married. If you're Muslim, you can get married, but you can't get married. There's no civil marriage. The only Jewish way for a Jew to get married in the state of Israel is with the Rabbanut. Period. Any issue which has to do with, you know, public Jewish law, you know, abortion, all sorts of issues like that are decided from a religious perspective. So it's a post-traditional society where we have returned to this Jews having autonomy, but not to the same degree of traditionalism that we had before. I hope that gives you a little bit of a sense of the distinctions between America and the history of it.
I would still argue, by the way, that the American model has more of its roots in Ashkenaz than the current Israeli model. I mean, irrespective of the geographic, the geographic structure, which seems to be similar to the European model, the point that you raised, which I think is the key point, and the one that I wanted to use to focus in on the difference here, is that in the American model, like the early Ashkenaz model and most of the pre-modern model, the community paid the salary of the rabbi. And therefore, the rabbi was responsive to the community. That's not the only therefore. I mean, there are other reasons why a rabbi would feel responsible to the community. The state within a state structure meant that the community was responsible for paying its way and paying for its communal functionaries. This model gets transplanted in the United States in a different situation, in a non-traditional environment, when separation of church and state, but it's still the model. Mm-hmm. In Israel, like in France, and that was what I was getting at, that where in the world did the French model get to Israel, where the government pays the salary, it guarantees an alienation between the rabbanut and their clients, meaning the people. And it's that alienation on every possible level that is the root of the problem, I think, in what's going on in Israel today and its religious-secular divide. So what I was angling towards is that, you know, and you could probably document all the ways in which there is alienation between the rabbanut and most Israelis, secular or even most datiim. So where does that come from? And then I wanted to move the discussion into questions like how the Haredi community got hold of the rabbanut and the significance of the new Israel rabbinate movements that are trying to address the problem.
Okay. First of all, I think there is alienation, but I think for, generally speaking, rabbanut is just a non-factor for most Israelis.
It's pretty alienated.
I think that might be called alienation, or it just might be, you know, just two separate. There's no sense of, you know, the only time the average Israeli has to have any contact with the rabbanut is when they get married, divorce, or death. That's it. There's no... Now, those situations often do cause alienation, and they are opportunities for developing a closer connection. But it's not like, people are looking for that relationship with the rabbi necessarily, and they don't have it. On those occasions, though, there certainly is alienation that emerges. So Rabbi Sanders is suggesting that is built into the bureaucratic nature and the state sponsorship of the rabbinate, which is something which Menachem Friedman has argued, which is, it was like nichshal mi lechatchila. Like, there was no way this rabbinate could ever succeed because it was built on compromises. It was built on being in a government capacity. So. Let's go backwards, though, for a minute. I remember, and maybe this is emotional, but I would like to key into the people sitting here. Do you ever remember being in the States and hearing that the chief rabbi of Israel was visiting? I remember thinking that was really cool. I remember thinking, wow, we have a state and we have a chief rabbi. Like, you know, to me, that seemed like something very special. That seemed like something very, part of the Zionist dream, that rabbis aren't just holed up in their little shul, but rabbis have public roles. Now, to me, that was a very dynamic, and that was different, and that was, exciting, and that had great potential. So basically, going back to your question, you would say, like, well, what went wrong? So I think if we look, we're trying to look at the problems, I would say that there are, two areas we can look at. One area is the difficulty in being a rabbi to multiple constituencies. What do I mean by that? Well, if we go back to our model of traditional life, so if you're the rabbi of so-and-so kehila, well, there's a little bit of variety, but basically everyone is committed to halachic observance. So you might be more mekil, you might be more machmir, but basically you are directing yourself towards a constituency of people who identify with the values that you believe in. Now, think about, for a second, before we get to Israel, think about synagogues in the United States. Today, most Orthodox synagogues are very monolithic. In a way, it's gotten much easier to be a rabbi of an Orthodox synagogue today than it was 30, 40 years ago. Because today, basically, the most people who go to Orthodox synagogues are observant or are sort of fall into line behind the observant community. If you think about American Orthodoxy 40 years ago, Jeff Gerach talks about the age of non-observance of American Orthodoxy. So I think sometimes about, I remember when I was studying for Smicha, and people used to criticize, I don't know if these are names that you're familiar with, people used to criticize people like Rabbi Joseph Lichtstein. Are you familiar with that name?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So Joseph Lichtstein was this YU graduate, early YU graduate, who came to this fancy synagogue on the Upper East Side, and he created this very vibrant community. I once wrote an article about him and his family, and I found they gave me access to the KJ archives, Kilath Jeshurun, the shul he was in. And I remember I found this memo from Joseph to his son Haskell, who's still the rabbi there, who's a very prominent Orthodox leader, who he said, "Hack," that's what he wrote, "Hack." And he was getting upset because they didn't say the avoda on Yom Kippur, and Haskell wanted to reintroduce it. And he thought that was charedization. This is in 1968. This is interesting. And he wrote, or they did a bridge version, something like that. You know, that's the part we all get excited about when we're reading about the blood. And right. So in KJ, that wasn't so aesthetic. Right. So he said, "Hack, when I, you know, came to the shul, what I wanted was to create a service which would be as decorous and as, you know, and aesthetic as the most reverential conservative and reformed temple, and as warm and spiritual as the most intimate local shtetl." That's what he said. But most people, you know, when I was in YU Smicha, would say, "Oh, KJ, Rabbi Joseph Lichtstein, those were the compromisers. Those were the ones who watered down halacha." You know, but when I think about it now, I think, what a difficult job to have a synagogue called an Orthodox synagogue, to know that a high percentage of the people in your synagogue are not observant, to be creating halachic policy such that it will remain within the guidelines of what we call orthodoxy, of traditional halacha, and at the same time, not to alienate the people who come there, because the synagogue can't exist without them, and because the whole raison d'etre of the synagogue is to facilitate Jews being able to connect, to associate. So that's why I say it's easier today to be an Orthodox rabbi, because there are fewer and fewer synagogues that are as diverse and as heterogeneous as that. So it's easier for a rabbi to direct their message. Now let's take that and think about a rabbi of a city in Israel. You know? Think about it. Just imagine you're the rabbi of Petach Tikva, or of Ranana, or Kfar Sava, or of Modi'in, or Netanya. A lot of people visit Israel. You're familiar. Now, these are cities in which there are more Orthodox Jews than almost any community in the United States, except for in Brooklyn or Lakewood. You know? There are lots and lots and lots of Orthodox Jews in Kfar Saba. Kfar Saba, I mean, maybe not more, but let's say, yeah, I live in Kfar Saba. Kfar Saba is known as a very secular city. Kfar Saba today has 100,000 inhabitants. 20% are Orthodox. 20,000 Orthodox Jews live in Kfar Saba. How many places in America have 20,000 Orthodox Jews? There are a few, but not that many. That's a lot, and that's a little town, you know? But there's also 80,000 non-observant Jews, not conservative reform. There's a nice conservative shul, maybe 200 of that, conservative Jews, but there's everybody else who are, the word secular doesn't even really describe it because they're not anti-religion. Most, all the studies have shown that most Israelis think that Jewish tradition is nice, that they have seders, and they're much more, the secular Israeli Jews are much more observant than all the studies show that American, Reform or even most conservative Jews are in terms of observance. They, you know, they don't eat kosher, but they don't mix meat and milk. There are all sorts of criteria. 97% have Brit Milah, 93% have a Seder, etc. Light candles. The other day I was walking by a home from shul with somebody from America, and I wanted to show them like a microcosm of Israeli society. We walked by, and there was this very lovely new home that was built in my neighborhood. Very, very nice architecture. And these big, beautiful windows. And there were two beautiful Shabbos candles that were lit there. And you looked into the salon, into the living room, and there was someone sitting on the couch watching this huge flat screen TV. And it was such a beautiful, just, you know, scene. I didn't knock on the door, don't worry. Shabbos, not right. My point is that if we're thinking about what is the difficulty that's sort of built into being a rabbi, the chief rabbinate, the system in which you're supposed to be servicing such a broad variety of Jews and be their religious leader is maybe, like we say, muad de puranut. It's really so difficult, and there are very few individuals. There were very few rabbis in America who could do what Joseph Lichtstein did in a community of 300, 400, 500, 600. There were, but it was a hard one. And you know, questions of mechitza and not mechitza. And, well, think about all the, what were the big battles in the '50s and the '60s and the '70s in America, and compromises people made. Now, just imagine you're the rabbi for this town of 100,000 people. And you're trying to set religious policy. You're trying to create a system which will be appropriate and which will not alienate the majority of people, remain within your halachic view, but at the same time address them. So I think that is a very big issue, and it may be an insurmountable one. There are examples. I mean, you know, Rabbi Lau seems to have succeeded. His son, David Lau in Modim, seems to be succeeding. There are some very charismatic, very talented, very capable people who are able to do it. Not, again, you know, agree on every detail, but basically seem to have found a way to do that. Maybe I'll let you continue, but you brought... Well, I'll just say one more thing. But the issue of training is also a big issue. Okay. I said before, rabbis like to learn. That's why they become rabbis. But training does make a difference. And if you haven't received any guidance as to tools beyond knowing halakha, beyond how did someone put it? I was at a conference in Serbia 2 years ago, and I met a woman who was a big professor of education. And we were talking about, and I said, and she was telling me about teaching teachers how to teach. I said, "What, can you really teach teachers how to teach?" I said, "You know, either they're good ones or they're not good ones." You know, she said, "Well, it goes like this: there are some people who are just natural teachers, and you really don't have to teach them. But and then there are some people who are never going to be good teachers. They're just lousy. They just don't have it. But then there's that whole middle group, and the middle group are people who have potential to be good teachers, but they don't have the enough skills to just develop on their own. And if they get proper training, then they can actually be very successful educators, and they can actually make a very big difference." So I think I would apply that to rabbis. There are people who just get it. The Laos of the world, they exist. And there are those who are just incapable. But there's a whole cadre of people who, if they were exposed a little bit more to understanding the complexity of the society they live in, if they were given skills of communication, if they were offered more insight into what is on the mind of the average Israeli non-observant Jew or the average person living in their community, it's possible that they could be very, very much better at what they do than they are now. But I just want to make one more point, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay? When I say training, it doesn't necessarily mean the classical rabbinical seminary. And I learned of, I grew up in NYU and I was trained in NYU, so I have, that seemed to be the model. That's how you make good communal rabbis. But here I want to demonstrate the other possibility. And maybe it's because I'm an academic, I try to sort of be open and try to, think about things beyond what's most familiar to me. Okay. What is the most dynamic Jewish movement in the world today? Anyone have an answer?
Chabad.
Undoubtedly Chabad. We're not talking theology, but there's no doubt about it. Chabad is the most dynamic Jewish religious movement of any denomination. Now, does anyone know that there are people here who probably travel, and you've met Chabad Shluchim, you've seen the way that they do things and their abilities to communicate with a wide range of Jews, topic we're talking about right now. Does anyone know how Chabad trains their shluchim? Did you ever ask yourself, how do these guys who grow up in Brooklyn, in Eastern Parkway, have really, really bad secular education? How come they're so much better at communicating with secular Jews than why you guys? It doesn't make sense, right? I know the Knicks. My parents made me go to the Metropolitan Museum. Now, I read the great books list, I should be able to be, I read the books. I read the Cliff Notes, right? No one has Cliff Notes anymore. My kids say, you don't need Cliff Notes, you have the internet. You click it, Google, summary. Dickens, all of Dickens, summary. Wiki Dickens, right. So I was writing this article a couple of years ago about rabbinic training and the use and how rabbis are trained to deal with assimilation. So I found out how Chabad rabbis are trained. Right. It goes like this. When you're in a Chabad yeshiva, now there are some who grow up as children of shluchim, that helps, of course. But that's not most of them. If you study in a Chabad yeshiva, when you're about 14, they let you out of school early on Fridays. And they send you with an older bachur, 16, 17-year-old, and they give you an area in town, one or two or three blocks. And they say, okay, this is your route. Every Friday, you're going to look for the Jewish owners of stores, doctors, whatever, you'll figure it out from the telephone book, however you figure it out. And you're going to walk over to them and say, hi, would you like Shabbos candles? Would you like to put on tefillin? Would you like to make the bracha on the Arba Minim? Every Friday. So that you start that when you're 14. And then at a certain point, you might get a responsibility to be in charge of some other guys, and you get a bigger area, and you become... So now figure that person starts interacting with a broad range of Jews when they're 14 years old on a weekly basis. And when they're 21, 22, 23, they get married. And then if they're good, they get sent out to somewhere else, some Yenemsville, wherever it is, to establish a Chabad house. And to support the Chabad house, because Chabad, they may give some seed money, but basically they have to create a business model in order to support themselves. It's a very different model. In the reason that Chabad is expanding tremendously in China today is because almost all kosher food is made from products that are produced in China, and somebody has to go around every day to the factories on a regular basis to the factories to check them. So let's say in Beijing, the shliach of Chabad hired a young Chabadnik who every morning gets on an airplane and flies to some region of China. And they get paid by the OU and by the United Synagogue and by all the different kashrus organizations. Okay, but getting back to my point here is that they're trained. By the time they're 22 years old, they've been doing this for 8 years. 8 years of personal connection, of shimush, of interaction. And that is worth, and it doesn't matter that they have these long beards and that they wear hats and they're black and they're all this and that, but they have a rapport and they have the ability to communicate and to understand the mindsets of people that is far more than the intellectually sophisticated why you